Okay, it is August the 12th, 2005. I'm Keith Clayton, talking to Bill Call here in our office, the Emeritus office, 322 Wilson Hall. And I would like to proceed more or less chronologically, if that's okay. As I warned you, you can either answer a series of questions that I have, or you can talk for a while about this part. Your choice.
Why don't we do the questions?
Do the questions. All right. I'd like to do it chronologically, starting with before but now, about family and stuff, where you were born and stuff.
I was born in Pennsylvania, where I grew up all my life. Went to public high school there, and then off to Bucknell in 1956. From Bucknell, I was admitted with a large class of four to Carnegie Mellon for graduate school, then known as Carnegie Institute of Technology, where I stayed for a while and got my PhD in 1965. During that final year...
I'm sorry. I want to hear about your family.
Oh, my family. My growing up family?
Yeah.
My growing up family. I'm the youngest of four. My brother is the oldest, and he still lives in central Pennsylvania. The next oldest child, Janet, lives in California. And my immediately older sister, Annie, lives in Hyde Park, New York. And as it turns out, my mother graduated from Bucknell in 1990. She lived in a town called Milton, which is just across the Susquehanna from Bucknell in central Pennsylvania. And my two sisters went to Bucknell. And there was no way that I was going to Bucknell. And through a series of things, like being turned down at Princeton for financial aid, I decided that I'd go to Bucknell too. Now, Bucknell is in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. There are three major institutions in Lewisburg. The first is Bucknell University, a fine place. The second is the U.S. Penitentiary, where James Hoffa spent time, another fine institution. And the third is the Pennsylvania House Furniture Factory. And that's about it for Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. But it was nice. It was about 150 miles from home, about a three-hour hitchhike that we all used to make.
Sisters?
Huh?
Your sisters as well?
No. Just me. When I say we all, that's a bunch of guys from school used to go down to Philadelphia. And I had to go down to Philadelphia to see Dottie now and then. Because Dottie was a high school sweetheart of mine, going to nursing school in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. And so I had to hitchhike back and forth. A task that was made a lot more difficult when the commander of ROTC forbade us to wear our ROTC uniforms to hitchhike. It was harder in blue jeans and t-shirts than it was in an ROTC uniform. So that was my family and Dottie and the Bucknell scene.
Tell me about Bucknell. You majored in psychology.
Eventually, I majored in psychology.
How'd you start off?
I started out in engineering, in civil engineering.
Forgot that, I did too.
And then I got involved in a psychology course with a wonderful guy named William Carr, C-A-R-R. And I was working all kinds of jobs because I was really pissed off that Bucknell wouldn't give me any financial aid. And so I was working all the time. I worked in the cafeteria for my board. And it turned out that I got a job working in the psychology lab with Bill Carr, who was working with goody birds. And these are big ostrich-type birds.
Albatross.
And the problem that Carr was trying to solve was a way to frighten them, because they would fly into the jet ports on airlines on Midway Island and cause all kinds of trouble. And so I fed and cleaned up after goody birds for a while.
My brother was an air control tower operator on Midway. He has lots of stories about goody birds.
I never saw a goody bird before, never seen one after. I think this was probably an Air Force project. I think it was a total failure, but that got me into Carr's lab, and then we did some, he also had thatch, and he was interested in olfaction, and so I learned a tremendous amount about control groups and design experiment working with Bill Carr. He was tremendous, and he did a lot for me. In fact, when I was a sophomore, he took me on a trip related to grant getting and so forth. And we went on that trip, it was a matter of 4 or 5 days, we went to talk to and ate a meal with Philip Teitelbaum at Harvard. Then we went down to Yale and met with Frank Beach and his laboratory. And then we went to Brown and met with Fachman and Schlossberg, the names in the field related to sensory perceptual stuff. And it just blew me away. So
haven't been the same since.
So then I by that time already switched into liberal arts, not knowing what I wanted to do. But the truth was that I started out as a 5-year engineering / liberal arts degree program. And so the first year there was very little engineering, some math stuff. Very little engineering. So I never really got into engineering before. I just dropped that program and settled into a straight liberal arts program.
Was psychology required in that engineering program?
I don't think so.
It was at San Diego State. That's how I took my first
course. Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't think it was, but I may be wrong.
They were modeled after MIT, which is supposed to have done that. That was the story.
Makes sense. So then after that, I went to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, got married to Dottie.
Why there?
I thought I was interested in cognitive things, and I was also interested in work that was being done by Moyer, Keck Moyer, who had a rat lab there. And he's doing hormonal things and stress-related things. So I thought I wanted to work in his lab, but I had this kind of untested interest in cognitive things. And so I went there and started to work with a guy named Ludvigsen, who was a Spence PhD, and he was doing human stuff and computer simulation kinds of things using this language. What is it? IPL5, International Cantonese Language 5.
Yeah.
And that was not very fruitful. And at that time at Carnegie Mellon, it was interesting because the place was run by Herb Simon and Al Newell's money. And Lee Gregg was the psychologist that was hooked up with Simon and Newell. It was clearly Simon and Newell's money. And while Newell was not in the department, Simon was, but his real appointment was over in Graduate School of Industrial Administration. But Simon was behind everything that happened. And so when I got there, either before or right after, Ludvigsen was hired.
Was that Simon of Testing Hypothesis?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did he really have a list?
Yes. Yes. That's true. And either shortly before or after, they hired Ludvigsen from Iowa, who was a Spanish student, and hired a guy named Ron Ernst from maybe Wisconsin. And they were brought in and paid for, certainly during the summers, to do cognitive stuff. And I don't think that suited either one of them. And I was working with Ludvigsen at that time, and so we did some silly-ass stuff that conformed to the notion that this is what we want done with this money. But that was not really very productive either. And then after several courses, one of which was taught by a guy named Walt Reitman.
R-E-I-T-M-A-N.
Yeah, yeah, Walt Reitman, who was in the inner circle of the Knowles, Shaw, Simon business, or I thought he was. He spent the whole semester with the nitpicking aspects of the IPL language. And I went into that course thinking that we were going to talk about psychology. And we were going to talk about the philosophy of modeling things and what one learns from models and how one tests models and creates models. We talked about none of that. It was just the language course. And then I and some of my colleagues decided that that wasn't going to do it, at least for us. And so we bailed out. And maybe that's when I went. Well, yeah, then I started to do that stuff with Ludvigsen, and he did that stuff. But so the whole cognitive thing for me was a great introduction and great history, but not very meaningful in terms of my career. But you know, these were the days that Carnegie Mellon was on the cutting edge at that time. And I can remember taking our boxes of IBM cards. Half a box would be a program, and the other half would be our
data,
our manipulations,
yeah,
or our language stuff.
Yeah.
And we would have to go over and queue up on the floor in the hallway to get to go dump our own cards in the mainframe. So it's kind of satisfying to look back and think that, you know, that was the start of something really big.
Was the output cards as well, or did you get printed output?
Printed output.
Yeah.
Printed output, either way down the hall or maybe in another building.
Often the next day.
That's correct.
It was similar to what it was like here, and usually at the top, often, too often, the top of the printout was fatal error.
Oh, yes.
Program did not run.
Right. And then back you go the next day. Yeah, right, right. And then you would look and you would sometimes see that the third card in was ripped. And the reader didn't like that. So that was my excitement at Carnegie Mellon. And then I was working on this tremendously time-consuming, laborious rat dissertation when I found out from my advisor that he was going to leave Carnegie Mellon. And Wayne said, "Bill," he said, "it looks like you had two choices." He says, "You can either work your buns off to get this dissertation done, and by the time I leave, and have no job, or you can go flitting around looking for a job and not get your dissertation done." So I decided that it might be better if I get the dissertation done, which I did.
That's ancient experience. If you leave before you finish your dissertation, your chances are you won't.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, being a rat man, it wasn't as if industry was clamoring at my door. I mean, I wanted to get an academic job. And PhD in general to get any kind of easy job. So that all worked out. I finished up late in the summer, had no job, Wayne left. And I don't know how I got hooked up, but I learned this. I learned of a job over at the Department of Clinical Science at the University of Pittsburgh, which was just across the gulch from Carnegie Mellon. And so I knew that a guy named Bob Miller there was doing monkey work and doing rat work. And so I don't know how I was introduced to that, as a matter of fact. That's why I can't come up with that. So at any rate, I went over and talked to Bob. And then the lab chief, or the director of the lab, was Arthur Mirsky. I talked to Mirsky, and Mirsky, for some reason, was attracted to my resume because I had this kind of computer experience. And he didn't quite know what computer experience meant, and I wasn't about to explain to him the details of my computer experience. And so I got a job working at a full-time research job in the medical school at Pittsburgh, where I was fortunate enough to work with Bob Miller, who I think taught me more about experimentation than most people get the opportunity to learn. Bob Miller was a wonderful mentor. For instance, he had this experiment set up where we had two monkeys in distant rooms connected by a TV network. And then we humans would sit in the third room, and we were taking heart rate and behavioral measures from these monkeys who were communicating. And Bob, being a full professor in the medical school, used to sit up there every morning and smoke his pipe and run these experiments by himself. He'd have somebody else help him hook up the animals and so forth, but then he would be at the controls morning after morning after morning. So finally I said to him, "Bob, this may be impertinent, but is this kind of an efficient use of your time to be sitting here watching these animals?" And without hesitation, he said, "Oh, absolutely." He said, "Because if you watch these animals, they'll tell you what's going on." A very, very interesting and sage piece of advice. And I'm reminded in what contrast sometimes that is, where we take a human subject in a little booth, put them in front of a computer screen, go in the next room, and only look at data as it comes off. Latencies and which buttons you push. where I still think that you might, just by looking at their eyes, know that that display stinks, they've fallen asleep, they're stressed out, but you don't know that if you're in another room. That was an important, sensible, it was an important lesson to learn from Bob. So I had a good stay at the medical school. And during the last couple of years, I taught introductory psych, my first teaching experience, down at Allegheny Community College downtown. I had taught a summer school session at Carnegie Mellon, my first teaching experience, which was extremely stressful. 3 hours a morning, 4 days a week, my first course. So we would work all morning, and then I would work all afternoon and all night to be ready for the next day. And that was a brutal introduction to our new person. But then I taught at night, and that was also a very good experience. Mostly adults. Ranges of abilities, the range of abilities was very wide.
I had a very similar experience. I taught at Northwest Evening School downtown Chicago, and what I liked about that was that they were adults, and they were committed to being there. I mean, they knew why they were there, and they worked hard, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too. There's a strange lesson I learned there that really just blew my mind. I'd given a test, and a couple of people didn't show up. And so I contacted them and made arrangements for them to meet me at another time. Two at a time. This was a team effort. And they didn't show up again. And I don't know how that particular thing, but event was resolved. But sometime during that same semester, I was giving another exam, and I was walking around in the hallway, just waiting for this time to go by. And I told this story to a chemistry professor who was also giving the test and hanging around the hallway. And he said to me, "Look, Bill," he says, "what you have to understand is that some of these people are coming back to school in order to fail, to get it off their back." Because there's a program, for instance, at that time in the police department in Pittsburgh, where they would pay for officers to go back to school. And an officer found themselves not in the position to say, "I don't want to." So he said, what those people do is they come back and fail. And that gets it off their back. And I said, wow. I said, that explains, that's a hypothesis I could not have come up with. It explains all their behavior. You know? And he said, I've seen it a dozen times. I couldn't fathom that,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It just wasn't within...
It was alien.
Yeah. Alien is the word. Yeah. So that, I'm glad I did that, because that, that I think, worked in my advantage when I wanted to come down here.